Welcome to another episode of the Wednesday Conversation. I'm Dusty White, and I'm here with Pastor Bob Foon of Cormdale Church and Pastor Chris Hemmelman of First City Church. On Wednesdays, we sit down to talk about how the gospel of Jesus Christ connects to the questions and issues of everyday life. And today, we're talking about the resurrection as history. But first, we have some snacks.
But first, listeners have come through. We have, are those Scotcheroos? Is that what you call them?
Yeah,
from Bailey, our listener friend Bailey, who delivered those on Sunday and said, hey, these are for the Wednesday conversation.
Dense.
Yeah, that's
They're
how, dense. Yeah, that was them dropping
There's
on the
some
table.
Density to these.
They're fantastic. And then today, out of nowhere, Amos brought us some pastries. I'm not a French pastry buff enough to know what you call these. I can only tell you they're delicious. They're like a croissant style dough turnover kind of thing. Amos, you're gonna have to tell us what this thing actually
turnover
is
kind of
so
thing.
That I can describe it.
That's good. That's good. What
I like is that among listeners, Amos and Kelsey, there's a real competition for who gets the most credit on the Wednesday conversation for being a good baker. And so I like that Amos is just kind of trying to push that forward and saying, hey, I want the award. There's a healthy competition in the kingdom of God. And this is what it looks like.
I also love that we can guilt people. And then the next week, there's just a ton
there's baked bounty.
Goods.
So yeah. Though it is Lent, we are feasting today on the Wednesday conversation. And if you're fasting during Lent, maybe just let this be an anticipation of what awaits you 4 days from now when we celebrate the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead and we feast together. That's what we're doing today on the Wednesday conversation. Thanks to our listeners. But we do want to actually get to the substance of what we're going to talk about today, which is the resurrection is history.
A reading from 1 Corinthians 15, starting in verse 3. For I delivered to you, as of first importance, what I also received, that Christ died for our sins in accordance with the Scriptures, that he was buried, that he was raised on the third day in accordance with the Scriptures, and that he appeared to Cephas, then to the 12. Then he appeared to more than 500 brothers at one time, most of whom are still alive, though some have fallen asleep.
That's that famous text in 1 Corinthians 15 about the resurrection. And what I wanted to do on this podcast as we anticipate Easter is to introduce you to N.T. Wright's case for the historicity of the resurrection. And so here's how I want to set up that. And I think this is going to be helpful to you, whether you are a Christian who just sort of is trying to sink your teeth more into the doctrine that we believe, or whether you might be a skeptic who's listening and wondering, you know, not convinced that the resurrection really happened, or I'm not sure how to take the biblical accounts of the resurrection. This, in my mind, is, well, not just in my mind, I think even in the mind of most apologists, is the central fact of the Christian faith. I mean, if Jesus Christ didn't rise from the dead, then we're wasting our time, Paul says in 1 Corinthians. So this is the event that matters most at the heart of Christianity. And so let me dial the clock back to when I was in seminary, Chris, and you can... You went to seminary later than I did, so you'll have to tell me if these trends were still there. I started seminary in 1999. I finished in 2006. I was on the 7-year plan. It was a long journey. I had other jobs while I was doing that. I didn't go to seminary full time. And in the late 90s, there was, you know, the trend in biblical studies. And when we talk about biblical studies, it's a very broad term that encompasses both like what seminaries do, but then also like academic biblical studies that are across the spectrum at any university level. Okay. So there are a lot of, you know, Jewish scholars are into biblical studies. Atheist scholars are into biblical studies. There are a lot of people who are just interested in the Bible as literature and in the way that it has shaped the modern world. And so the trend in biblical studies in the 90s was the Jesus Seminar. And so every year at Easter, you'd get these articles in Time magazine. The Jesus Seminar was this group of liberal theologians, people like Marcus Borg and John Dominic Crossan and others, who would get together and they would like be like, hey, do you think Jesus really said this? Do you think this really happened? And they would all like vote. And then, you know, here's how it would come out. It was like, I want to say there's like 30 scholars at the table. And, you know, they would have these meetings once a year in places like Newport Beach, California, or, you know, New York City. They'd all get together. It would be this like public relations thing because they were good at sort of like working the media. And then the vote, here's how the vote would always come out. Jesus didn't really say that, or that didn't really happen. Like, it was just like warmed over liberalism of like, of course, everything that was supernatural or miraculous, none of that actually happened.
Yeah.
What we ended up with was basically like the ethical part of the Sermon on the Mount.
I've heard that the way they voted, they had like little markers, like likely said it, didn't say it, maybe said it. They kind of had these color coded things.
Yeah, it was like, it was like a papal election where there's like a colored smoke that rises up. It was very dramatic.
Yeah.
And they were good at like playing to the public relations game. So when I was in seminary, that was like all the energy in the culture was like, oh, you know, of course the resurrection didn't really happen. Well, then N.T. Wright happened. And the reason Christians should be very thankful for N.T. Wright, who still is alive and working today and, you know, is an Anglican biblical scholar, but what he really did, and he's an interesting figure. He's a controversial figure. He's a figure lots of people disagree with in various places, but he is a great grace to the church. And here's why. Because what he did was sort of put all of that to rest in such a dramatic and comprehensive way that no one says any of that anymore. And it's basically because of the work he did in this book that I'm about to survey for you. He came along, and so N.T. Wright was interesting because he's an Orthodox Christian, so he believes the scriptures, but he's also a great, well-respected academic. And so he sort of took the approach, instead of saying, I believe the resurrection of Jesus as a Christian, so how can I convince everybody that it happened? He took the opposite approach and said, what if we just take the approach of a historian looking at what happened in the first century? And he did that work so comprehensively and made the case so convincingly that he just shifted where the debate is. And so I appreciate that where I sit today as a pastor in 2024 at Easter is a very different place than 25 years ago in 1999 when I started seminary. The conversation is in a very different place, thanks in part to the work that Wright did on the resurrection. And the joke about N.T. Wright in conservative biblical circles is he gets justification wrong, but he gets the resurrection right. Mm-hmm. That's probably an oversimplification, but that's what a lot of people like to say.
Yeah. And to your initial point, my seminary experience was different because of N.T. Wright. Less of, you know, where some of that weird kind of biblical scholarship was more focused was more at Paul. But the conversation, we weren't talking about the Jesus seminar.
Yeah.
We were talking about the liberal scholarship, yes, but liberal scholarship that had been refined and actually improved because of guys like N.T. Wright.
Yes. So I want to survey for you as a listener, the very briefly, but hopefully helpfully, what N.T. Wright does with the resurrection. Because here's what I'm convinced of. N.T. Wright has made the resurrection of Jesus a conversation about history, not a conversation about faith. Because what everybody wanted to do back in the 20th century was to say, well, it's fine if you want to believe in the resurrection. You can believe whatever you want, but that's different from did it happen? You know, it's like, so people wanted to say, we don't need to worry about whether it happened, Chris. As long as it's meaningful for you to believe that, feel free to believe it. Now, of course, those of us who believe the Bible were never satisfied with that answer, but that was sort of how people made sense of, we're really uncomfortable with the idea of a guy rising from the dead, but we want to affirm people's religious beliefs. They sort of, Francis Schaeffer used to call it upper story, lower story. It was sort of like we separate faith from the realm of history, and you're free to believe whatever you want in that faith category, as long as you're not trying to convince us that it happened in history. N.T. Wright made the conversation a conversation about history. And this is, by the way, 780-page book.
Large.
It's a big
book. And it's one of five. This is one of a five-part series that are all the same. So this guy's prolific. He writes a lot of words.
Yeah.
And actually, none of it is uninteresting. Like when you read him, you're like, gosh, this guy's a really good writer for writing this much content.
So this, what you're saying, Bob, is this isn't the case for Christ by Lee Strobel.
Exactly. This is something totally different. And I have a lot of conversations with people who are skeptics, who are non-Christians. I have a lot of those kinds of conversations, and I always try to get people to dealing with the resurrection and saying, look, the place we need to start is, did the resurrection of Jesus happen? That's the most important question. And usually when I'm in those conversations, in fact, I've been in one recently with a friend, and I just bought this book and sent it to his house. And I said, if you want to argue that the resurrection didn't happen, you've got to reckon with N.T. Wright. So I want you to read this. And let's start the conversation here, because you're going to have to answer the case he's making if you want to even carve out any space to believe the resurrection didn't happen.
Yeah.
I'm not going to give you that ground. You know, it used to be like, well, you don't believe the resurrection. I'm a Christian. I do believe it. How do we arrive at common ground? I think N.T. Wright has changed it to where if you don't believe the resurrection of Jesus happened, now I'm going to say, well, you're making a statement about history, and the historical facts are that it did happen. So you're gonna have to make a better argument than N.T. Wright has made.
I like that, where you don't sort of just concede that, or allow those who are arguing against the resurrection to just sort of say, well, we have the evidence, we have the argument. You're the one that you have to prove.
You believe faith.
Yeah, you have to prove otherwise. Where it's like, no, actually, the argument has been made. If you're going to be taken seriously, you've got to reckon with this.
Correct. And so if you're a Christian, I want you to know that's the side of the historical divide that you stand on. And I want to read a little bit to you why that's true. So I have in front of me The Resurrection of the Son of God. That's the title of the book, published by Fortress Press in 2003. Here's what N.T. Wright says. I intend to challenge the dominant paradigm in each of its main parts. In general terms, this view holds the following. So he's going to summarize for you. Here's what sort of modern biblical scholarship in the year 2003 holds. Number one, that the Jewish context provides only a fuzzy setting in which the word resurrection could mean a variety of different things. Two, that the earliest Christian writer Paul did not believe in bodily resurrection. Three, that the earliest Christians believed not in Jesus' bodily resurrection, but in his exaltation, in his going to heaven in some kind of special capacity, and that they came to use resurrection language initially to denote that belief, and only subsequently to speak of an empty tomb. Four, that the resurrection stories in the Gospels are late inventions designed to bolster up this second stage belief. Five, that such seeings of Jesus as may have taken place are best understood in terms of Paul's conversion experience, which is to be explained as a religious experience internal to the subject rather than the seeing of any external reality. In other words, the early Christians underwent some kind of fantasy or hallucination. And then six, that whatever happened to Jesus' body, it was not resuscitated and certainly was not raised from the dead, in the sense that the gospel stories seem to require. So he's saying, at the time he's writing, there's the dominant paradigm for you. The Jewish people use the word resurrection to mean a lot of different things. The earliest Christian, Paul, didn't believe in the bodily resurrection. Neither did the earliest Christians. Turns out that was a later belief. And what they were talking about was some kind of experience like Paul had on the Damascus Road, where he had an encounter of some kind that was a spiritual one, but it wasn't with a Jesus who had gotten up bodily out of the grave. And so N.T. Wright's about to say, I'm going to show you why all of that doesn't hold water. All right, so the first place Wright wants to start is to say, first, I have to convince you that we're talking about a historical question, because he writes, it has frequently been argued that whatever we mean by the resurrection of Jesus, it is not accessible to historical investigation. Some have even suggested that it is not to be thought of as an event within history at all. Against this, I shall argue that the resurrection of Jesus, whatever it was, can and must be seen as at least a historical problem. So he says, we're going to make this is a historical problem. It's not a problem of faith. The question of the resurrection is a question of history, and I want to explain to you later on why he thinks that. But first, he wants to put to rest the idea that, you know, the Jewish vision of resurrection meant a lot of different things, right? So let me read you another section. He says, there is no difference between pagans, Jews, and Christians. Those are the three groups of people who existed in the first century. They all understood the Greek word anastasis, which is the word for resurrection, and its cognates to mean new life after a period of being dead. Pagans denied this possibility. Some Jews affirmed it as a long-term future hope, and virtually all Christians claimed that it had happened to Jesus and would happen to them in the future. All of them were speaking of new life after death in the popular sense, meaning a fresh living embodiment following a period of death as a state. Nobody thought that this had already happened, except the Christians, in respect of Jesus. So what he's saying is, you know, you can think about life after death. And when we talk about life after death, usually what we mean is like some disembodied existence somewhere, right? The quote unquote afterlife. And he's saying, well, of course you had people who believed in some kind of ongoing existence. They didn't use the word resurrection for that.
Yeah.
That's a different thing.
Yeah.
When Jews, Christians, and pagans spoke of resurrection, they were all talking about embodied existence after a state of being dead. Mm-hmm. And a huge chunk of this book is N.T. Wright quoting pagan author after pagan author after pagan author after Jewish author to say all of them seamlessly understood the word resurrection to mean embodied existence after some period of being dead.
So those who are trying to make the argument that he's arguing against, was that an honest argument in his mind in the sense that they genuinely believe this? Or was this in some ways kind of a shady trying to manipulate what the pagans, those in the first century believed about this word? You know, like there's a way in which, you know, sometimes you can make the argument, no, I genuinely misunderstood how they use the word, and I think I'm going to argue it in this particular way, versus no, let's actually try to shift what they were clearly saying. How does that argument that's being made kind of come across?
I don't have any idea because I'm not as deep in the sort of tradition as he is, but he does quote a number of scholars who he says are making a case or had made a case at some point in the 20th century that when the pagans thought of resurrection, they thought of it this way.
Okay.
And so the reason he quotes so many pagan sources is he's trying to put that argument to bed and saying anybody who says that hasn't read the pagans well.
Yeah.
And so it does seem to me that there's legitimate scholars out there who would have said that's how you should understand it.
And the
stories they often use are like in Homer, where, you know, they have those dream sequences where it's like he goes to Sheol or to the realm of the underworld and he has like fellowship with these heroes who have died. And the thing that N.T. Wright points out is, and everybody realizes that's a dream sequence. Like it's not an embodied, they're not embodied. They're shades. They're ghosts. No pagan would have understood that to be the same thing the Christians were talking about when they talk about Jesus' resurrection.
Yeah.
All right. So Wright is making this full argument to say, A, the Jewish and pagan world did not believe that some disembodied existence was the same thing as resurrection. When they used the word resurrection, they're talking about embodiedness after being dead. Now he goes on to say the historical argument, the way he's going to work backward to history, and this is really fascinating for Christians to think about. He says the way this argument has generally worked is we start with the gospel accounts. We start with Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. They seem to indicate that Jesus is risen from the dead. And then people move forward into the New Testament and sort of ask, like, what did the early Christians, what did they do with those beliefs, and so forth. And Wright says the problem with going at it that way is it always makes it a sort of first an issue of faith. Because obviously what the gospel writers are trying to convince you of is, at the end of this book, Jesus rises from the dead. And so it forces you to do something with, like, do I think that happened or not, before going forward. What Wright does is he says that the right way to go about this is to work the opposite direction and say, what did the early Christians believe? And how do we know what they believed? Mm-hmm. And then we can ask the question, why did they come to those beliefs? Okay, so he starts with 1 Corinthians, which is the earliest New Testament document, and with Paul. And he says, let's just start with what Paul and the earliest Christian documents tell us that Christians believed. And then we'll get to the Gospels, but let's get to them at the end. Let's start with the question of this community of Christians that we know. So every historian says there was a thing called the early church. They existed in history. We have the catacombs in Rome. We have the existence of the Christian faith today. Everybody agrees Christians came from somewhere. Somehow we got this group of people in society called Christians. So let's start with what did they think? And let's ask the question, how did they arrive at those beliefs? And so that's what Wright is going to do. So he says, oh, and he wants to remind you, sorry, let me say this too. He wants to remind you what it means to do history. And he wants to remind you that historical investigation is different than scientific investigation. As you all know, if you studied the scientific method back in 10th grade chemistry, the scientific method focuses on repeatable events that are observable, right? So science is focused on observable events that we can test, make a hypothesis, do the experiment, examine the results, and then do it again if we need to continue to test our hypothesis. Historical inquiry is different because it's not repeatable. It's not dealing with something that's observable or repeatable. The question of did Caesar cross the Rubicon is a question of, well, it either happened or it didn't, but we can't test it by repeating it.
Yeah.
We're asking, is there enough material in the historical record to give us a fair sense of conviction that that did actually happen versus it just being a myth? And so he wants you to remember that when we ask, is something a historical fact, we're not asking a question of science, we're asking a question of history. And it's a different way of analyzing the question. So he says it this way: history is the study not of repeatable events, as in physics and chemistry, but of unrepeatable events like Caesar's crossing of the Rubicon. Okay, so that's, keep that in mind as he goes forward, because it's helpful to think about the argument he wants to make. Now, I'm going to read to you from page 686. So this is the second to last chapter of the book. He's done all of his background work. Here's the argument he's going to make for the resurrection. So I want you to follow this. It's a 7-step argument. He's going to start by telling you 2 things that are historical facts, and then he's going to walk you through his argument for the resurrection. So listen carefully. The 2 things which must be regarded as historically secure when we talk about the first Easter are the emptiness of the tomb and the meetings with the risen Jesus. Once we locate the early Christians within the world of Second Temple Judaism and grasp what they believed about their own future hope and about Jesus' own resurrection, these 2 phenomena are firmly warranted. So what he's saying is, when you understand the social world they lived in, and that within that social world, they said the tomb was empty and we saw the risen Jesus, he's saying no one in that social world would have ever claimed those things unless there was something to make them claim those things. In other words, everybody knew that dead people stay dead, that you don't have an encounter with someone who just died. And everybody knew that if there was a tomb, we could just take you there and show it to you. And so if the Christians were claiming the tomb was empty and everybody actually knew it wasn't, it'd be very easy to disprove. So he's saying those 2 data, the fact that there was an empty tomb and that people had encountered someone they claimed was the risen Jesus, those are historically secure, is the language he uses. Let me read you now his 7-step argument. To sum up where we have gotten so far, the world of Second Temple Judaism supplied the concept of resurrection, but the striking and consistent Christian mutations within Jewish resurrection belief rule out any possibility that the belief could have generated spontaneously from within its Jewish context. When we ask the early Christians what had occasioned this belief, their answers home in on 2 things: stories about Jesus' tomb being empty, and stories about him appearing to people alive again. So what he's saying is, the Christians believed something distinctly different from what Second Temple Judaism believed. Second Temple Judaism believed there will be a resurrection again at the end of history. Suddenly you have these Christians all saying the resurrection began when Jesus rose from the dead. And he says, when you have something in history that erupts that suddenly and that's so different from what the entire social milieu around it believes, there has to be a reason that belief came about.
Yeah, it didn't just evolve because of teaching within Second Temple Judaism.
And he's saying, when you ask the Christians why they believe that, 2 things come to the surface. 1, stories about Jesus' tomb being empty, and 2, stories about him appearing to people. Number 2, he says, neither the empty tomb by itself nor the appearances by themselves could have generated early Christian belief. The empty tomb alone would be a puzzle and a tragedy. Sightings of an apparently alive Jesus by themselves would have been classified as visions or hallucinations. Step 3, however, an empty tomb and appearances of a living Jesus taken together would have presented a powerful reason for the emergence of the belief. So he's saying either one of those in isolation doesn't do anything, but when you have them both together, now you have a powerful reason for the emergence of this belief that Jesus rose from the dead. Number 4, the meaning of the resurrection within Second Temple Judaism makes it impossible to conceive of this reshaped resurrection belief emerging without it being known that a body had disappeared and that the person had been discovered to be thoroughly alive again. So he's saying if that belief emerged, the only way it could have emerged is that it's known in that context that a body had disappeared and the person had been discovered to be thoroughly alive again. Otherwise, again, it would have been very easy to just say, to tamp these stories down and say, what do you mean there's not an empty tomb? His body's right here. Five, the other explanations sometimes offered for the emergence of the belief do not possess the same explanatory power. Six, it is therefore highly probable that Jesus' tomb was indeed empty on the third day after his execution, and that the disciples did indeed encounter him, giving every appearance of being well and truly alive. Final step, seven. This leaves us with the last and most important question. What explanation can be given for these two phenomena? Is there an alternative to the explanation given by the early Christians themselves? And Wright is going to conclude, there isn't. There is no alternative. The best explanation is Jesus rose from the dead. Now, he realizes that when he says that, you're going to be like, no, now you feel like I've just like given up on history. But the case he's making here is important because he's saying, when you work backwards from what the early Christians believed to why they say they believed that, the empty tomb they claimed, and seeing the risen Jesus alive, and then you ask, what possibly could have led to them believing those things and holding them so strongly that they would have been martyred for them? He says, the best explanation is, the only explanation that holds water is that Jesus had actually risen from the dead. Now, let me read you a couple more sections where he sort of builds out his thinking here, okay? The early Christians did not invent the empty tomb and the sightings of Jesus in order to explain a faith they already had. They had developed that faith because of the occurrence of these two phenomena. Nobody was expecting this kind of thing. No kind of conversion experience would have generated these ideas. Nobody would have invented it, no matter how guilty or forgiven they felt, and no matter how many hours they pored over the scriptures. To suggest otherwise is to stop doing history and to enter into a fantasy world of our own, a new cognitive dissonance in which the relentless modernist, desperately worried that the post-Enlightenment worldview seems in danger of collapse, devises strategies for shoring it up nevertheless. In terms of the kind of proof which historians normally accept, the case we have presented that the tomb plus appearances is what generated early Christian belief is as watertight as one is likely to find. That's an important statement he's making there. Yeah. He's saying it's not that they came to a belief and then invented these stories to back it up. Actually, the data shows the opposite, that the only way these beliefs would have arisen if something happened to cause people to suddenly think that some guy had risen from the dead, because he has this funny line in here of like, even pre-Enlightenment people knew that dead people stay dead. Like, that's another new thing in the world.
Yeah. Well, that also makes some sense of, you think of Luke 24, Road to Emmaus, Jesus has to, like, it's in light of the resurrection of Christ that the teachings that Jesus points them to make sense. They were missing it. So, I mean, you can say, yeah, the scriptures taught the resurrection in the Old Testament, but they didn't see it and understand it until the resurrected Christ was in front of them. And so that had to be in place before this belief could be set.
Now, he's going to use a category here that's a very important category, and the category is inference to the best explanation. He says when you're doing historical investigation, you have a set of data points. And the data points he's giving you is, you have this early Christian community, they claim Jesus is risen from the dead, there's an empty tomb, they claim they've had these encounters with the risen Jesus, this community continues to grow and increase, we can point to it in history. What you have to do is you take all that data and you make the inference to the best explanation. You say, what explains this data most probably? And this is how we do historical work. You're always reasoning. In fact, he says this happens even in science. He says, not only in history, but physical sciences themselves often proceed not simply by deduction from hard data and not always by induction from the particular to the general, but by inference to the best explanation. He uses this example of, you know, if you see an elephant, he's a British guy, so you gotta give him some slack here. He says, if you see an elephant walking through London, you're going to wonder why. And then if you hear a report on the radio that an elephant escaped from the zoo, you just make the inference to the best explanation of, oh, that elephant I saw walking through the zoo, it's not the Parthians invading London, and it's not some weird aberration from outer space. It's the elephant that escaped from the zoo that I saw walking through. He says your brain is just doing inference to the best explanation. Do you know? Did you see that elephant escape from the zoo and then make its way to where you are? No. You're just inferring, man, that's weird. I saw an elephant walking through London, and then I heard this news report that an elephant escaped from the zoo, and I bet that's the same elephant, because why else would I be seeing it? That's an example of inference to the best explanation. And he's saying, this is what all this data causes us to do, is to say, what is the best explanation of the historical data that we have? And his answer is, the best explanation is the bodily resurrection of Christ from the dead. I'm going to read you his conclusion at the end of this chapter. The standard alternative theories have been ruled out as we have made our way through this book. The common idea that when the early Christians said Jesus was raised from the dead, they meant something like, he is alive in a spiritual, non-bodily sense, and we give him our allegiance as Lord, is historically impossible. Not only, as we saw in part one, did the words simply not mean that, one might as well say that Jesus was crucified by the Romans meant, as I think of Jesus, I experience a sense of the crushing power of pagan empire. If the early Christians had meant that, a belief of that kind could not explain why they hailed Jesus as Messiah and Lord, or in particular, why their belief about their own future resurrection took the very precise shape it did. The suggestion that Paul's view of the resurrection had nothing to do with what we think of as a body has been shown in part two to be exegetically unfounded. The idea that there were two parallel streams of resurrection belief in early Christianity is ruled out by the evidence surveyed in part two and three. The widespread belief that the resurrection accounts in the Gospels are back projections of Christian belief simply will not work, as I've argued in part four. Historical argument alone cannot force anyone to believe that Jesus was raised from the dead, but historical argument is remarkably good at clearing away the undergrowth behind which skepticisms of various sorts have been hiding. The proposal that Jesus was bodily raised from the dead possesses unrivaled power to explain the historical data at the heart of early Christianity. So his conclusion is, the best explanation is, Jesus rose from the dead. That's the only thing that explains the data. And again, the reason I think this is an important and compelling argument is because N.T. Wright is doing the history work here to say, hey, if you're going to say Jesus didn't rise from the dead, you've got to account for all this historical data. And I'm explaining to you in this sort of course of argument why no other explanation makes sense of it, like the simple explanation the Bible gives us, which is that what if Jesus actually did rise from the dead? And yeah. He's got a funny section here where he basically says, you know, I realize that's not a historian thing to say, but it's also good historical work to just admit when there's no reason to reject the best explanation.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is it would seem that to undermine his argument, you would have to do much more precise historical work in some ways, or offer up maybe a much more cynical view of history. I've heard people, you know, I'm sure you have too, people make kind of the argument that all these things sort of took root because of like power plays, and people like Paul had these agendas or whatever it may be, that there was kind of this cadre of people that wanted to impose this particular view, and there were these other kind of sects of Christianity that had different views, and they were kind of pushed to the margins, and so it becomes a very cynical view of history, a more complex view that you can often hear. And to me, this historical argument sort of smashes the cynicism too. Like, I think that's what's refreshing and beautiful, is it's making a strong, clear, and in some ways, you know, human dynamics can be complex, but there's a beauty and a simplicity to this and a strength to this, that if you're going to reject it, you either really do have to do some more precise history, or you kind of have to go the cynical route. And when you go the cynical route, it, in a lot of ways, that's just kind of a cop-out. And so that's what I think he just does some, his work here is so beautiful because it forces an honesty too, like a historical honesty as you wrestle through the resurrection.
Well, and I think what I appreciate about it is it starts by just treating the New Testament documents as history. It's saying like, look, regardless of, if you don't believe the Bible is the word of God, fine. But you do have to believe it's a reliable record of what the earliest Christians believed. It is a historical text. The Christians believed something, and as best as they've told us, this is what their apostles told them to believe and what the earliest churches believed. And so what he's doing there is he's just sort of doing an end run around all the people who are like, well, we don't have to believe the resurrection because we don't believe this is the word of God, and you guys do. And so, fine, if you believe that, you know, because this inspired text says so, Jesus rose from the dead, fine. I don't have to believe that because I don't believe it's an inspired text. What N.T. Wright is just saying is, okay, fine, but it's a historical document. And so you have to do the work of history to ask, where did these people come from? And why did they come to this set of beliefs? And what happened in real time and space in history to cause this community to arise? You know, it's like anything, right? If you have, you know, take any modern example, take something like the, you know, the rise of sort of the Trump wing of the Republican Party. That's been a shift over the last 10 years, right? Like there was sort of the Tea Party back in the sort of Mitt Romney days. And then sort of now, you know, the Republican Party has become very Trump oriented now. Why? Well, there's an explanation for that. Something happened in history to create that.
Yeah.
And he's doing the same thing. He said, if you're in the Judaism of the first century, and suddenly there's this community of people who call themselves Christians who say that Jesus rose from the dead, you have to ask why, where did they come from?
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the same way we treat any dynamic today. When there's a community of people that arise, we go, well, where did those people come from? And what was it that occasioned their sort of rise?
Yeah. And what this, like apologetically, what this does is, like what you said, the kind of the end around of the different objections that people can have, the different ways they want to argue about inconsistencies and all the sort of things to kind of undermine the authority of Scripture. It reminds me of a friend of mine one time was at a wedding. A pastor friend, he was at a wedding and he was talking with a guy who was more or less sober, but talking with this guy about all his objections, asking all these questions about the Bible. And my friend just like, hey, look, setting all that aside, if Jesus really did get out of the grave, does that not change everything? And the guy's like, well, yeah, absolutely. And so it just kind of cuts to the matter like, hey, you can, you know, there's all these things here. Yeah. But if we just, let's just kind of go around that and just say, hey, listen, if Jesus truly was resurrected, did that not change this whole discussion? Well, let's just account for that, how the New Testament accounts for that and the historical argument. It kind of forces, again, in a discussion with people, some of the smoke screens and the distractions and cuts right to the matter. Because if they accept that, then you kind of work from there into other areas of Scripture. But I just love how this just kind of, let's just get to the heart of the matter. And wrestle with that, and then let the other pieces fall into place as they may.
So the good news is, as we gather to celebrate the resurrection of Jesus this weekend, we're not just gathering as people of faith. We're gathering as people who believe something happened in history in real time and space. Just like Paul said in 1 Corinthians 15 that you read at the beginning of the podcast, Dusty, that Christ was buried and raised on the third day. And this work by N.T. Wright helps give a lot more substance to the historical aspect of that claim and of the faith we profess. And so if you're a listener, I don't imagine every one of you is going to want to read an 800-page book, nor do I recommend that you do unless this is really a compelling topic to you. But here's what I will tell you. If you have intelligent skeptics in your life, I think this is an important book for them to read. I don't know if you're familiar with Molly Worthen, who's a professor at the University of North Carolina, who recently became a Christian like in the last 2 years. But as she tells her story, this book was significant for her in helping her come to the conviction of, oh, this resurrection is not just some claim of an inspired book of faith. This is a historical claim. So if you want to get the book, I think it's probably a $40 book. It's not cheap. But I would just say start with the last two chapters. Read the last two chapters. That's like 40 or 50 pages. And then that will tell you sort of where the argument is resolving. And then you can decide, okay, do I care about going back and reading the 600 pages before that? And if so, what sections do I want to read? So I think this is not a book everybody needs to read, but I think it is for those of you who have intelligent skeptical friends or just who need more sort of like convictional data about the resurrection of Jesus and why it matters and why it's verifiable and historically valid, I think this is an important book to have on your shelf. So I would recommend to some of our listeners that this might be a good one for you, but it's intimidating, it's big, it's long, and it's scholarly, and so it's not for everyone.
The goal of this podcast is to equip our own churches for discipleship and mission. So if you're a Christian or a church leader in another context, thank you for listening in. We pray that this conversation might be helpful to you as you minister in your context. And we always love to hear from listeners. So if you have thoughts, questions, or future podcast topics, send an email to podcast@cdomaha.com. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time for another episode of the Wednesday Conversation.